House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs, June 24, 1981, Hearing Room F, 1 p.m.
Absolutely.
No problem.
I think that's a wonderful bill.
Maybe the business and consumer affairs can tell others.
Come on, we're going to draft all the members present.
Goodbye, Ray.
We have before us Senate Bill 849.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, while Mr. Love is coming forth, the proposed Legislative Council Amendment 51581 was adopted by our committee for Senate Bill 294. It did not get turned in from council with the committee report. So Mr. Barrow says the amendment is okay with him, and if it's your pleasure, we need to adopt it.
Mr. Chairman, before I move for adoption of the amendment, I assume that it will not apply in its exact language to this bill in terms of the pages and the lines that it affects.
No, we have to clean it up in
council.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move for the amendment dated 51581, originally drafted for Senate Bill 294, to be submitted in concept of Senate Bill 849.
Okay.
Do you want to move the other amendment now as well? Okay, all right, fine.
Let's do this first.
Okay.
All right, discussion. Any objection?
No,
so move. Bill, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. Senate Bill 849A, I'm going to refer to it as 849, but it's the engrossed version, is basically a housekeeping bill involving the Savings and Loan Code. Let me indicate initially that there's nothing in that bill that involves any other code or affects any other financial institutions other than the Savings and Loan Associations. All of the sections and amendments of existing law, there's no new sections that are being added involved in connection in with the bill. I just might very briefly suggest in the material I've handed out, this is an oversight, that you may want to look at the very last page of that, and there's a chart that I have just so that I realize there's any kind of misunderstanding of how the system works in with the savings and loans, and I'll just make this super brief. It says savings and loan system, and you'll notice I have the Federal Home Loan Bank, they're at Washington, D.C., over there, and they charter the federal chartered savings and loans, and there's nothing in this bill, basically, that affects them because the legislature can do very little. They get their marching orders from Washington, Congress, or the Federal Home Loan Bank, and that's one set that is a federally chartered savings and loan like the nationally chartered banks. Over on the extreme right of that page, you'll see the state of Oregon and Salem. And that's the state-chartered savings and loans. And the state-chartered savings and loans receive their marching orders, if you would, from the Oregon legislature, from the supervisor of savings and loans. And it's with the state-chartered savings and loans that this bill is concerned. Now, I want to make it clear, because these have insurance of accounts, of the savings accounts, which is an agency in the middle of the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, because of that fact, and we're involved with the Federal Home Loan Bank system, provide some credits to all savings and loans, be they federally chartered or state chartered, that we do have some provisions of federal law which apply to state chartered associations as well as federal chartered associations. And I thought perhaps that this overview might indicate, well, how come the Federal Home Loan Bank controls this? And they do it because basically of the insurance regulations, if they feel that it maintains to the insurance of the savers' accounts. But we're really talking today about state chartered associations and that part of the Oregon law, Chapter 722, that pertains to state chartered associations. Let me...
Bill, may I ask
yes.
a question, Chairman? Before you go on, how many... Give me a little geography here. How many state charters are there roughly in the state versus how many feds?
Well, the supervisor of savings and loans, Quentin Hess, is here, and maybe he can answer at least the number of state chartered.
18 state chartered. How many feds?
About the same number. We have about 35, 36, Mr. Markham, savings and loans in the state. About equally divided.
May I ask one more educational question?
You bet.
What is the purpose of the Federal Home Loan Bank?
What is the purpose?
Yeah, and I'm not tuned in at all.
Well, the Federal Home Loan Bank, I guess, oversimplified, kind of performs the services of of the to the savings and loan system that the Federal Reserve performs to the banking system. There is a bank. There's a board of the Federal Home Loan Bank. Three people appointed by the president, confirmed by Congress, that are the equivalent of the Board of Governors of the Fed. And then they have district banks, of like they do with the Fed, and the Federal Home Loan Bank of Seattle is the district bank that involved with us. And their main concern is that they're a credit source to the savings and loan industry. They provide a credit window for the savings and loan industry that they can have. They also are involved in the supervisory and regulatory aspects because of the insurance feature. The FSLIC, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, which acts like the FDIC for banks, actually is not as independent as the FDIC, and it's really an arm of the Federal Home Loan Bank. So they do the supervision for all insured institutions. In addition, the state of Oregon supervises us because we're state chartered. If you were federally chartered, Representative Markham, only the feds would go in and do the supervision. But that's their basic source: regulation, supervision, and providing a credit window. It grew out of the, got established in the 30s, and it's all part of the home ownership, home financing program that got developed at that time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other basic questions?
Yeah. On page 11 of the bill, Mr. Love, the section dealing with the disclosures, I guess I'm having difficulty understanding between the financial condition of the association as it applies to auditing records, which I think is public information, and the kinds of things that might be disclosed and where they would come from in that special section that deals with the supervisor allowing disclosure.
Out of state. You're Representative Roberts referring to what kind of became referred to on the Senate side as the infamous or famous Section 20 of the bill. And
I didn't know it was famous, so I'm sorry.
There are about three or four sections I was going to highlight, and I'm willing to start there, Mr. Chairman, if that's one that you'd like to have. Let me say the Section 20 that's in the A engrossed version is a compromise that was worked out on the Senate side. There was really by the supervisor of savings and loans and the chairman of the Senate committee. The original proposal that was in the bill was to put the savings and loan associations on par with the commercial banks. Now, let me say this grew out of an effort by Willamette Week to have access to some of the records that the savings and loan supervisor considered to be confidential on the examination of a savings and loan in the state. And the feeling was by the supervisor and by the corporation commissioner that information should not be made public and need not be made public under the existing law. It's very clear that under the banking code that information would not be made public, but there was some different language in the savings and loan code that existed. We tried and attempted to remove that language from the savings and loan code so that the savings and loan code would read the same as the banking code and would mean that the information that comes on the with regard to examination and supervision and regulation of a financial institution wouldn't be open to the public routinely.
Question. If I may interrupt. Bill, why weren't you able to sustain that in the Senate?
Well, okay, get that, there's one other key point, I think, before you get that point. This matter did go to court. Let me say, in the code, the Public Disclosure Act, it provides there that if the agency and whoever seeks the information has it comes to loggerheads, that the Attorney General's office becomes the referee, which surprised me because I've always felt the Attorney General's office was supposed to advise various people not to make policy decisions and decide how matters should be applicable. But in the disclosure statute, that power is given to the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General ruled that he had the power to make the decision whether there should or shouldn't be disclosure, not the savings and loan supervisor, and that the matter basically should be disclosed. Then the matter was taken to the circuit court, and the circuit court in Marion County determined, well, yes, the Attorney General should make the decision, But he was wrong in making the decision that it should have been disclosed, and that under the circumstances there shouldn't have been any disclosure. So therefore, Willamette Week still doesn't have its information, even though the determination was reached that the Attorney General would, or the court said, would make that decision. And I believe that case is now up on appeal to the Court of Appeals and has not yet been decided. The net result, what we sought was to, again, have parity with the banking system. And there's good reason, I think, why there shouldn't be willy-nilly disclosure of financial institutions, examinations, and records that we can go into. And there isn't any good reason, in my opinion, why it should be different for the savings and loans and the banks. But as a matter of basic compromise that was acceptable, the feeling was, well, let's clarify the situation, leave the exceptions in there for good cause that can be shown, but let's make it clear that it's the savings and loan supervisor that's going to pass judgment on whether it should or shouldn't be disclosed, not the Attorney General. And that is the purpose and the way that the amendment exists in Senate Bill 849 in the A and Gross version. They've kept in there a provision that if the overriding public interest exists, there can be disclosure, and the determination of that is a person, is the savings and loan supervisor who has the responsibility for the supervision of the savings and loans and for the responsibility as a member of the state of Oregon into the public. He's appointed and designated in by down through the chairs by the governor's office as part of the administration. So that's the kind of the history of how it got there. And that's where it is, and it does not put the savings and loan supervisor on par with the banking superintendent, but it does clarify the question as to who tosses the balls in the air and makes the judgmental decision. Now, let me indicate to you, and I didn't bring it with me, I don't think, but as you notice, I have this chart here, and when a state savings and loan association gets examined, generally, they're also being examined by the federals. At least in many cases, they come in at the same time because the federals have examinations because of the insurance. And the federal makes it absolutely clear that that examination report is confidential between the Federal Home Loan Bank and the board of directors of that association. And they make it clear they're not showing it to anybody. And it all kind of gets meshed in together. And I think that part of the system gets defeated if the state supervisor has to show his examination reports to the newspaper whenever they decide they think that they want to find out what's going on out there. And I guess I'm trying to indicate at least that the even the provision here is more liberal than exists under the federal system for the examination and more liberal than exists under the banking system today, but it's one that the supervisor, the corporation commissioner, and the industry feels they can live with. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Bill. Go ahead.
What was the newspaper after? To see an examination paper?
Yes.
By his office?
Yes. Of a particular savings and loan associations and some matters that was involved.
Bill, what part of this bill says that the Attorney General, you're not any longer going to be the referee? He's going to be the referee.
He's okay on that.
I think it's the new language in the last part of Section 2 that says that the supervisor shall make a determination under the subject and pursuant to the standards and so on for exercising the supervisor's discretionary authority. And this is making clear that it's the that language wasn't there before, that the supervisor shall make that determination. And before the supervisor does it, he will do certain things. But it's clearly putting ball in the supervisor's pocket. And I think before, under the old language, it wasn't clear to what extent the supervisor's pocket in the S&L code was affected by what's over in the public disclosure code.
Was there any particular rationale from one or two board members of the Senate that simply didn't want to put the S&Ls in the same language that are in the banks? Is that what stopped it? Would you care to reflect on that, Bill?
I think there were some members of the Senate committee who perhaps felt that that the provision in the savings and loan code so modified was the better way. There was even some talk, well, we ought to put in the same and we'll change the banking code and move it back down, but there wasn't any effort basically to do that. I think it was somewhat of a compromise situation that looked like was an acceptable solution I don't know what the position of the newspaper publishers are here, and my understanding is that they may be here appearing on that section today.
You guys are happy with what you got.
Well,
is that right?
No, it's.
Depends
on your alternatives.
Okay, it's satisfactory.
Okay, Bill, let me take the issue and see if I can further clarify it for myself. You're familiar with the bill that came through the House last week with regards to collateral on public deposits for state chartered savings and loans and banks that dealt with a 25%, 110% issue. Okay, let's suppose that a state chartered savings and loan was under the 110% situation because their situation was not as stable as it might be.
Okay.
And a local public body that had funds deposited in that savings and loan decided they'd like to know how stable that savings and loan was. And they made a request to be able to see whatever would be necessary for them to determine whether that savings and loan was still operating on the 25% collateral situation or whether it's on the 110% collateral. Would this bill allow that to happen?
Well, the bill would allow that to happen if the supervisor determined that that was in the public interest, that they should know that.
That could be a public interest issue, however.
Yes, it
could. Is that the kind of thing that, I mean, setting aside the newspaper issue, is that the kind of thing that might how it might be used?
I think that's perhaps one of them that might come up, or I would imagine perhaps that the supervisor, the corporation commissioner, might well determine that, well, look, that's your question, we'll find out for you and we'll let you know. Now, I guess it's a question, do you believe the supervisor, do you believe the corporation commissioner?
But they might at least be able to find out whether they were in a 110% collateral situation.
Yeah, I would say that they could do that, and it was certainly if they determined that the overriding public interest was that they should allow that to happen, they could do so. But that would be one. I would imagine most of the time the request may come from people in the press for whatever reasons that they might want to find out what the information is. I don't know whether the other ones would come, and perhaps the supervisor could indicate whether they've had other requests. I don't know whether there have been requests from people in to see the examinations or not.
Thank you, Bill.
More questions for Ms. Lawful? Ms. Lawful?
All right, let me just...
Go ahead.
There was about five sections that I just wanted to call to the committee's attention. And then if there's any of the other ones, one of the five we've already talked about, if there are any of the other ones, why I'm happy to go through them. I do have a section-by-section summary that follows, and let me indicate that most of these almost all of them are technical, of some matter clarification, and don't involve any substance. You'll notice that two sections in were removed. There was some concern that maybe it might be expanding the deposit-taking authority of the SNLs versus the banks, and rather than get into that kind of a discussion, why we agreed over on the other side to just remove those sections and any amendments that were proposed. So there's nothing in there with regard to expanding deposit-taking authority, and I believe that it's safe to say that the banking industry and the other financial institutions have no objections to any part of this bill. The very first one I would like to refer to is Section 4.1. It's on page 4 of the bill, so that there be no misunderstanding here in light of other hearings that this committee has had. Section 4.1, again, is somewhat of a clarification. Involves mergers involving savings and loans with savings and loans. But I want to make it clear, it's just savings and loans with savings and loans. It doesn't involve savings banks. It doesn't involve commercial banks. It does involve clarification with regard to some out-of-state savings and loans, including the federally chartered savings and loans, so that it would be clear and I think the committee felt that, say, Pacific First Federal is a savings and loan. There's a lot of business in the state of Oregon, one of the largest savings and loans here. It's headquartered in Tacoma in Washington, but if association wanted to merge with Pacific First Federal, it could do so because Pacific First Federal is doing business here, even though it's not a state-chartered association. So that section and those amendments clear up the questions on the kind of the merger consolidation issue, but I want to make clear that it's strictly dealing with savings and loans and other chartered savings and loans, be they state or federal, that would be involved. I just wanted to call that to the committee's attention in light of prior discussions that we've had. The second one that I would call to the committee's attention is Section 16 of the bill, Section 16 is on page 9. And in this was a provision to raise from $5,000 to $20,000 in the Savings and Loan Code, the maximum amount that could be distributed to heirs and beneficiaries without having to go through probate. Now, there's other legislation in that involves more than the Savings and Loan Code and the others, where the agreement is that the $20,000 should be 10, and it's going to be made 10 uniformly. And I believe that at some time, and Mr. Jones is aware of that, this bill, I take it to conform with the others, that $20,000 should be amended to 10 to be consistent with the others. The Senate was recognized that at the time it was over in the Senate. Nobody was sure what was going to happen in that area, so the determination was made, let's leave it as it is and see what does happen. But it's a question of uniformity with other provisions, so that what's in the banking code, what's in the savings bank code, and so on will be $10,000 for all of them.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
Mr. Right. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Love, it would save time procedurally if we were to make that amendment and adopt it now.
That's fine with me.
Since we have the two other minor amendments, including we need to renumber the sections because the sections are deleted.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question on the area first? Bill, is the list, the ABC list that goes down there, the priority with which the savings and loan would make a determination who got the monies?
Correct.
And if there were another document of any kind, a will or whatever, that said this does not go to my children in or whatever, this would still override that will?
No.
And how would you know that this was all right?
No. If there's a will involved in with that, of what would be done, then the amount would go through upon the will. And I guess I've got to say that you got to take this section with some other ones that weren't being amended that's in the code. This language, Representative Roberts, is standard and for the banking code and for the S&L code. I think it was language was created by the bar, as a matter of fact, somewhere to deal with it. But this applies if the person comes in and claims the withdrawal of the deceased in the particular orders to give some protection. But if there is a will or something that establishes that it will go in a different order, then you wouldn't pay it out in this manner.
Mr. Chairman, another question. If, Bill, could a depositor request someone else to be on the records, not as a will, but in terms of records at the savings and loan, to say, you know, if I should die, this is where it goes, or take precedent over such a thing?
There's kind of three sections here that we get involved with, Representative Roberts. First of all, if in the savings account, and this is no difference whether it's a bank savings account or savings and loan savings account, if that account provides for what I call survivorship or joint ownership, and it says to a husband and wife or a mother and daughter or whatever, that upon my death it goes to the other person, or we're joint owners and the survivor thereof, that takes precedent because that's what the account provides. That's number one. So we're really talking about here is a situation where we've only got, say, a single name on the account. There isn't any other provision for survivorship or joint ownership, and on that account there isn't a will that says all of my assets are going to go someplace else. Okay. And we want to be able, in many of those cases, to expedite the distribution and not have probates. And for a lot of people, $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 in a bank or savings and loan is the bulk of their assets, and this authorizes a distribution within that without having to go through formal probate and still protects the financial institutions. That's the purpose of this legislation.
Thank you. That's helpful.
But it will not override either whatever the command is on the account, which will take precedent first, or the second would be any will that would be involved that would purport to apply to the assets.
Nobody ever leaves me money, so I never know how these things work, Bill.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Do you want to take action on that, or have you already done so, or whatever you want to do?
We haven't changed it.
We got four. Okay. Chairman, I'll move. We delete the 20 and replace it with a $10,000 amount on line 15 and 30. Are there other places in those two, Jim? Page 9.
Just two places, I think.
Section 16. And also to renumber the bill in its proper sequence. Okay.
Any objections?
No. I'm on.
All right. I just have two other sections that I just want to comment on, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, that you might have. The next one is just briefly on Section 18, and that starts on page 10, runs over to page 11. I just want to know that there was an increase there of the, shall we say, the part of the assets of a savings and loan that need not be put in real estate or liquidity items from 25% to 30%. That likewise was a compromise figure. I think we originally asked for 40 and it was settled on for 30. Roughly speaking, just very simply, savings and loans in the state of Oregon have to have currently, I'll use the current figures, 75% of their assets either in what we call liquidity items to meet cash and treasury bills to be able to pay for withdrawals and things like that, or in real estate loans. The other 25% of the assets can be in offices and can be in consumer loans in the areas where we've been given authority. I think, as you know, within the last year at the federal level, there's been a liberalization and a trend to provide more consumer powers to the savings and loans, at least family-type consumer powers, as distinguished from business-type consumer powers, and unsecured non-real estate loans. And because of that, and because some of the associations were relatively close to the perhaps 25% limits, the feeling was that some more leeway should come in that area. This does not mean the industry is getting out of the housing business, but still, when this passes, 70% of the assets of the savings and loan will have to be in real estate loans or in what we call liquidity items, which are basically government bonds that can be used to pay savers or pay withdrawals or pay things that they have in that area. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention so that you wouldn't think that this was something that was opening up the door that was getting the savings and loan industry out of the housing market, real estate market.
What else?
The final one I have is just the last section, which is section 26. I'm using old numbering, the numbering in A and gross. Again, so there would be no misunderstanding of what we did. And that has to do with the reciprocity rule that exists in the current law. And in essence, the law, as you can see there in the three lines on 26, this is on page 13, basically provides that when the laws of Oregon, or when the laws of another state would let an Oregon association go into that state, then that association chartered in that state could come into the state of Oregon. And we had some experience in that. We do have an office in Utah. We had some problems getting an office in Utah. At the time when a Utah association was interested in merging with an association in Oregon, and I think the feeling was that, well, they had a nice law on the book that said that, yes, foreign associations go into Utah, but they just never let you in. The supervisor turned down your applications or wouldn't let you in. And so, in fact, they de facto, at least prior to that time, they were not admitting foreign associations into Utah. I think the state supervisor and the corporation commissioner and attorney general's office felt that the law as it read here said, well, if the statute says they can go in, I don't know the mere fact administratively they don't let you go in. You may have some reciprocity that we don't play ball the same way over here. What this does is basically says that it's a matter of the laws, the regulations, and the administrative actions in those states say that there's reciprocity, and then we can have reciprocity over here, and I think that's an important factor. If we're going to have foreign associations coming to do business in Oregon, then by the same ground rules ought to apply to Oregon associations going there, and that's the purpose of that amendment. I'm happy to speak to any of the other sections or answer any questions that anyone wants.
Yeah, with regard to that section you were just dealing with, 26 bill, it says are prohibited from transacting business in the state. That's different from saying starting a business or operating a business. Transacting, I think, is a broader word than that. Would that mean that a savings and loan company out of Utah would not be able to loan money to a business person in the state of Oregon?
Well, first of all, I guess the non-black type is existing law, and I haven't thought too much about the question that you were raising, but I guess it would mean that a non-Oregon savings and loan, be it Utah, we'll use Utah as our example. First of all, they can't transact business in this state in the savings and loan sense unless they get a license from Mr. Hess to be able to do so. Now, they can make loans in the state if they don't have offices and so on here, because there's certain other provisions that we have in the code that says in order to attract money that outside foreign people can come in and use their money to to make loans within the state if they don't have offices, they don't have employees, they don't have other people doing that. They can make their money available or buy loans or originate loans without being considered a transact business. And I think transact business here is one that refers to taking deposits and putting up some mortar and brick and putting a sign up on the wall that says that we're here doing business. It's more than just making loans. That's part of it, but it's more than doing that.
So it would be based on if this were the situation that if the home base of that savings and loan association, for instance, were in Utah and Utah was not cooperative in terms of Oregon participating in business in their state, that we could prevent them from putting a branch office, for instance, in Portland.
Yes.
Okay.
Assuming they're not grandfathered in or there isn't some other provision. The matter came up with one of the associations now. It's been consummated since then, but it came up at the time when Utah Association was going to acquire an Oregon Association, which they have done since then. And at the same time that we were turned down to get a branch in Ogden, we had applied for it, and they hadn't bothered to let any foreign associations in. Subsequently, that's been changed, and we have been admitted in the state of Utah. But there could be some other states where that would come up, and the feeling is that we want our regulators to be able to look beyond just the mere statute to how the administrators administer that statute, and that's the purpose of the changes that would be.
Wouldn't prevent a very wealthy banking type from Utah from
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Bassinet, do you leave it as an underwriting decision to make any difference between on-road or off-road use or any of that? As far as you're concerned, it's just the personal injury protection, and that's all you're concerned about. Is there any difference between, you know, a dirt bike?
The dirt bike normally does not carry any insurance at all, liability or otherwise, because they are out in the boondocks and they don't carry any kind of insurance on it. And the one exclusion by statute that affects it is that if you're riding an unlicensed, unregistered vehicle, as I recall, and if they're in a race or preparing for a race, the trail riding type deal. Now, there, other than correcting modifying the decision of the Supreme Court of Oregon, there is one other substantial change, and that's contained in page 3. On line 11, in the middle of the line, we have added the words aggregate of 52 weeks. And that same change is down in line 18. Some of the insurance companies, in the past, it has said a payment for 52 weeks. Some of the insurance companies have been interpreting that to mean that it applied for 1 year from the date of the accident. And if you were totally disabled from that period on, that would be all right. But the intent of the legislation was that if a person was injured and was off work for 2 weeks, or maybe 3 months, we'll say, and then attempted to go back to work and worked for a month with interruption and attempting to restore themselves back to the normal, and then had to go back to disability, that time would have been lost. That month in there would have been lost, and they would have only paid for 1 year from the date of the accident. We're making it very clear that we intend this to be the aggregate of 52 weeks. If it takes 3 years to do it or 5 years to accumulate 52 weeks of payment, that's okay. That's what the law intended it to be.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
That promise?
When Frank got hurt last year in his accident and went through some hospitalization and surgeries and then went a period of time and went back to work and then after that period of time had an additional surgery and then was off again for a period of time from that additional surgery, it would have removed that centerpiece of time and used the weeks that he was actually disability for. Because that's not an unusual circumstance with some kinds of accidents. So.
That's right, especially with people who are trying to restore themselves back into the mainstream of society.
That's
the benefit of,
They're more likely to go back to work, right.
It's an encouragement to go back to work because they aren't surrendering anything. They aren't losing anything by trying to go back to work.
Oh, that's good.
It's an incentive to go back.
Yeah. Ms. Jones?
I had a couple more questions, but let Jim do his
Mr. Chairman, thing, Mr. Committee,
whatever
on line
his thing
19,
is.
On page 3, it also says all reasonable and necessary funeral expenses incurred within 1 year. it sounds a little bit like those are an aggregate expense that you could accrue at your funeral.
Long funeral.
And I suggest it should read if death occurs within 1 year after the accident and injury. But it's not a major point. It just seems
that those funeral directors who
funeral
just left would like this year-long
year
long funeral.
Period.
What do you want to insert in?
I don't think we need to insert anything unless we have to amend it somewhere else. It's just a little bit.
No motion. I'm saying that I would say before you make a motion.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions first. I'll be really brief. I am having some difficulty in looking at the bill with regard to the summary, which seems to deal with a completely separate issue from what the bill deals with. And I feel a little concerned that people who may have looked at this bill number and read this summary will not really understand what's in the bill.
Why don't we? Can we prepare an amendment to go in with it that's a new bill summary?
I don't know, but it doesn't seem to
what
deal
it
with
means.
It. Yeah, there's right. Nothing in the summary that deals with mopeds or motorcycles. If it is, I'm missing it. Where is it?
Yeah, after the bracket is worth it.
Oh, the B. Oh, I've got the wrong bill. Oh, I'm working with the wrong bill. That helps a lot. I feel better.
Okay.
I kept wondering how they managed it.
Mr. Chairman, would this have the effect more young people, boys or girls,
thank
running
you.
Around on motorcycles without any pip?
No.
And the reason I'm leading up to it is the question about would it put more people on welfare?
No wonder it looks so bad.
I don't see, in theory, when the people purchased automobile or motorcycle insurance, they were well aware that it did not cover them at that particular time. It's only because of the interpretation of the law, which most people are not cognizant of what the law says. They know what their insurance policy says in theory, but they don't know what the law says. And therefore, they don't know that they were running without insurance, with insurance, because the policy said they did not have insurance. When they get injured and go to the hospital says, hey, the law has been changed, and therefore you do have insurance if your dad has a car. And then they would make a claim against their dad's policy. So I don't think it'll affect one bit whether or not youngsters have insurance or do not have insurance, because they're now riding their motorcycles with the understanding that they didn't buy it.
Is there, Mr. Chairman, is there any other one signed up to testify on the bill?
No. We're ready to go.
I might add for Representative Roberts' point that the original, I don't know whether you were looking at the original.
Yeah, I was looking at the A engrossed, and I didn't have the B engrossed in front of me.
The reason that the bill has been changed from the original intent of the bill, which was to allow the people on Social Security to opt out of buying PIP insurance, is that some of them felt, with Senator Wyers, that they should not be forced to buy insurance that they could not make a claim under. In other words, the medical insurance, they said, hey, we got Medicare insurance, we don't need that type of insurance. When we explained to Senator Wyers, as well as to some of the other sponsors of the bill, as well as most of those, by the way, are on the insurance committee, they saw the logic of deleting that particular section of the bill because, one, in December of last year, Congress changed the Medicare law, which used to say that it was primary and it paid first and did not attempt to collect money from the auto carriers. In December the 5th, President Carter signed the law that says Medicare is now secondary. It pays the bills first, but then it collects from the automobile insurance company. It did not include the deductible, if a person had a deductible, which they all did. It did not include the 20% of the medical expense, which they all had. And it did not include the essential services, the $18 a day for the loss of the housekeeper or whatever it might be. So the Senate Insurance Committee amended the bill to correct the Garrow decision, deleted the other provisions because they found that they would create havoc because people would not have insurance for their grandchildren riding in their car or other passengers who were not on Medicare. And so they felt that it would be better to go with this bill and correct that decision.
Tom, can you tell me in the Senate with this bill, what the vote looked like when it came out of committee and what the floor vote looked like?
It was unanimous out of the committee, and Senator Wyers voted against it because it was the only no vote in the Senate. And he explained that he was not voting against the correction of the Garrow decision. He was voting because we were not mandating motorcycle to carry insurance.
Oh.
Didn't go far enough.
Didn't go far enough.
Yeah, right.
You wanted to add on $100,000 for the helmets?
Yeah.
And that was the only reason. There was no opposition to Senator Ted Kulongoski carried the bill on the floor, and there was no opposition in the committee in the Senate either.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Donna.
Chairman.
Any more?
No, I don't have any more questions.
Concerns?
Well, just because I have a son who's a motorcycle rider, I always look at these things with a great deal of consternation. He's been insured as one with a motor vehicle and a motorcycle, and insured as a motorcycle owner only. And I get concerned about it getting more and more difficult, which it seems this bill does in some senses, to be able to obtain motorcycle licensing, insurance, when in fact he does it to make it cheap for him to drive to work. And he's, had it for 3 or 4 years and never had an accident. And I just don't want to make it more difficult for him. And I'm not sure that this isn't going to make it more complicated.
No, this has nothing to do about the availability of insurance for motorcyclists. It talks about whether or not the
law
requires.
But his motorcycle would not be automatically insured, though, if his car was insured as it is now.
That's right. Now, if, as an example, the bill does not pass, then obviously, in order to pick up the slack, the automobile insurance premiums have got to go up to cover the motorcyclist.
Threaten. They always threaten.
That's facts.
I'm not real excited about it. I want you to know that. But.
Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we take 5 minutes recess to...
Could I ask the committee something to take this time? We sent out a memo with regard to the reception July the 1st on a Wednesday. Some have responded, some have not.
That was the second item, wasn't it?
And the second item is one from Keith Burns. We're recessed, yeah.
We have before us Senate Bill 708 still. And let's take a good bill.
Where's Bradbury?
He's a getting them. He said he'd be out in the hall puffing smoke.
It's good.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 708 be engrossed, the floor do pass.
Any discussion? Now, clerk on the roll.
Representatives Bradbury?
Aye.
DeBoer? Dolan?
No.
Markham?
Aye.
Parkinson?
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman, if we want the funeral home and bombers and directors and consent calendars, I'd be willing to make an additional motion.
Okay.
Let's take a motion to do that.
You want to do that?
Yeah.
Consent calendar.
In the Pyramid Club?
Senate Bill 879A. I'll move we put on a consent calendar.
Okay.
In the Pyramid.
Is that a motion?
Yeah,
yes.
I did.
Discussion? No objections?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we also place Senate Bill 885, the Pyramid Club bill, on consent calendar.
Okay. Discussion? Objections? No.
Keep my hand out of the way.
Done?
Thank you. Committee adjourned.
Let's see.